The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the participants, not of Reuters News.
Often people, you know, they see the rise of Russia and think, oh, well, hell, this is a source of concern. But actually you need to think, well, you know, where the Russians are now is probably where the USA was in, I don't know, 1995.
In the last few years, Russia's military has been on display, first in the breakaway region of Georgia, then in Ukraine, and now in Syria. There's been a lot of discussion online about just how far the military has come and how good some of the hardware now looks after decades of decay after the Soviet Union fell. This week on War College, we talk with Nick DeLarinaga. He works for Jane's Defense Weekly, which is the authority on weapon systems all over the world, and he specifically covers Russia. One of the things that we talked about, beyond sophisticated missiles and robots, is one of the things that might be a little bit less obvious as a motivation for Russia going into Syria. Proving your weapons on the battlefield is a terrific way to advertise them for sale.
You're listening to War College, a weekly discussion of a world in conflict, focusing on the stories behind the front lines. Here's your host, Jason Fields.
Hello and welcome to War College. I'm Reuters opinion editor, Jason Fields.
And I'm Matthew Galt, contributing editor, War is Boring.
Today we're talking with Nick DeLarinaga. He's the Europe editor for IHS, Jane's Defense Weekly. And anything you want to know about defense and weaponry, that's the best place to turn. So, Nick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, what new pieces of Russian equipment are you seeing Russia field right now? They're involved in Ukraine to a certain extent now, and certainly in Syria. Is there anything you haven't seen before?
Well, they've used a variety of systems that we haven't seen used before in an operational sense. For example, in Syria, they've used the opportunity of that conflict to deploy some of their latest fighter bomber aircraft, the Su-34, Fullback as it's known to NATO, and that's the first operational deployment for that aircraft type. Perhaps the most interesting thing we've seen them do is we've seen them use long-range land attack cruise missiles in Syria, which is something that the Russians never really went in for before. You know, back in the days of the Cold War, the Russian ethos was very much, particularly from the maritime point of view, very much on area denial. So in terms of, you know, preventing NATO navies getting close to Russian shores, they never really had this kind of capability to project power at distance. And particularly in terms of, you know, having a long range land attack cruise missile, like, you know, the American equivalent would be the Tomahawk. You know, the Russians never quite had that equivalent capability. And we've seen them now use these long-range land-attack cruise missiles now from their bomber aircraft, from their surface warships, and now from their submarines as well. So they've kind of demonstrated a complete triad of long-range land-attack missile capabilities, which was, you know, something they didn't have during the Cold War.
Now, obviously, right now, they're deploying conventional warheads. Is that the kind of weapon that also can be equipped with nuclear warheads?
Potentially. I mean, they're the right size to be able to fit a nuclear warhead. I mean, they're pretty much the same size as an American Tomahawk, which has both a conventional and a nuclear warhead. So, yeah, they could put nuclear warheads on them. You know, obviously, that comes into nuclear weapons treaty proliferation issues. You know, America's got a treaty with Russia setting out, you know, exactly what the number of nuclear warheads it can have and, you know, the delivery mechanisms for that. That's called New START. It's the name of that treaty. So there are restrictions on that. So at the moment, we don't think the Russians do have nuclear weapons on these cruise missiles, but certainly they could do so. You know, the Americans have been quite forceful in complaining that the Russians have been breaching another treaty, which is called the INF Treaty, which restricts land-based long-range cruise missiles. And the Americans have been quite vocal in saying that the Russians have been developing these. And it's probably just a land-based variant of the same missile they're firing off from ships and from the air. But actually, according to this treaty, they're not allowed to have them on land. From ships and from the air is fine, but not from land. And the Americans have been saying they have been developing these.
What's the advantage of these weapons? Why, especially if it's in violation of a treaty, would you develop them?
I mean, that's a very good question. when you're looking at, projecting power at distance, having a very long-range missile is, really advantageous because it allows you, a standoff distance. You don't have to get, necessarily into another country's airspace, to be able to launch, it. In the case of the cruise missiles they launched from their naval vessels, they launched these missiles from the Caspian Sea. So, it's a several thousand-mile journey. I think it's about 1,500 kilometers, something like that. These missiles had to fly before, reaching their targets in Syria. So they didn't have this range. They wouldn't be able to strike from the Caspian Sea. So that's kind of the main advantage in them.
Nick, I'd like to ask about these tiny tank drones that we're seeing more about. Popular Mechanics just ran a piece about the Ura-9. I'm curious if you could explain to us why you think that Russia is kind of pushing these now. And is there a future in this kind of technology? Are we going to see more of these tank drones?
Sure. Well, they're known kind of in the defense industry as unmanned ground vehicles, UGVs. Typically they've been used in the West for, dangerous roles that you don't want to send a person into. So for something like bomb disposal, you'd have basically a little robot with a camera and an arm, that can go and prod stuff. And, you'd send that out to go look at what you might think might be a bomb or, an IED or something like that. And there's always been talk about maybe putting weapons on them. And obviously the Russians are certainly going down that route at the moment. They've developed quite a few different UGVs with weapons on them, machine guns for the most part. And again, you'd use that for somewhere you wouldn't want to send a person, somewhere particularly dangerous. Or maybe just something, maybe for, monitoring a border or something like that, where, you could have one person controlling several of these, ground-based robots that could cover quite a large amount of distance. I mean, to say these are killer robots is kind of, it's often something you hear in the media, but that's perhaps over-egging the point to a certain extent, because there's a man controlling them. The difference is he's just not sitting in on the robot. He's just, a couple of hundred meters further back.
Any idea how effective machines like this are?
These haven't been seen in combat, so it's really hard to say at this point. A great, part of that is how good the sensors are and how good, the data links are at sending this information back to the person operating it. If you've flown one of these small drones or something, often the camera when it's not very good, you don't get very good visibility of what's around you. So that is quite limiting.
Yeah, that makes sense to me because a human being can swivel in an instant, has peripheral vision.
Auto zoom, auto focus essentially. You don't need to think or take time to focus on something. Your eye just does it like that.
Are they heavily armored? Do they even care about that?
You'd have less need to armor them because, you're not trying to protect a person. But obviously, you'd want the bit of equipment to be survivable in a battlefield, so you would want to armor it to a certain extent. But there's not a great deal of information out there about what the Russians are. The actual specifications, they say they've got this system, but it's not actually been seen in combat. It's not actually used by the Russian military at this point. It's just kind of something they're demonstrating their capability that they can do this.
It's more about kind of showing it and saying, this is something that's coming. This is something that we're working on.
Yeah, exactly that. It's not something that the Russians are deploying to Syria at the moment. It's not something that we saw in Ukraine. It's just the Russians saying, look, we can do this.
Which is kind of the case, and correct me if I'm wrong, also with the Armada T-14, their brand new shiny tank that they're saying is amazing and costs hundreds of billions of dollars. Can you kind of tell us about that tank?
Well, it's a fascinating piece of design. So the main tank the Russians use at the moment is a tank called the T-90, and that's their top-of-the-line current tank in service at the moment. But that tank, even though it's called the T-90, is actually basically the kind of just a younger brother, basically, of the T-72 tank, which the Russians developed in the early 70s and the late 60s. So really what the Russian army is using at the moment is a really old piece of kit. They've modernized it a bit, but it's still essentially old and has a pretty nasty habit of blowing up quite spectacularly in war.
And when you say they blow up, is it that if it's... Why? I should ask why.
Well, there are a couple of reasons for it. The main one is because... So in the West, we tend to have four men in our tanks. And we do that, we have a driver, a commander, and two guys who are involved in loading the gun, because the gun is manually loaded in like an American tank, the M1 Abrams. You have someone manually load the rounds into the tank. The Russians decided to take out that guy, so only have three guys, and the has an autoloader system, so the gun automatically loads itself. But the problem with that is it means you can end up having large clusters of ammunition in the middle of the tank, which aren't secure. So say in like an Abrams, you'll have kind of the ammunition in separate compartments and you'll take it out to put it in the gun. Whereas with this autoloader system, you don't have that. So if anything gets into the middle of, you get hit by a missile or hit by an anti-tank round, anything that gets into the middle of the tank, breaches the armor, will hit this enormous concentration of ammunition and blow up the entire thing.
So the Armada? Yeah.
So what they've done with the Armada
everything?
Is they call it an unmanned turret. So instead of, having someone in there with around all that ammunition, they put all the crew members at the front of the tank, and there's no one in the turret itself, so they call it an unmanned turret. And what that means is, if the tank is probably still just as likely to blow up if it does get hit, but the crew will be able to survive because they're in a separate compartment, so they're kind of shielded away from that. So that's the main kind of advantage, really, of this unmanned turret from the crew's point of view, is that if they do get hit, they're much better protected because they're away from the ammunition.
Have they fielded these T-14s anywhere yet, or has it just been like in Victory Day parades and such?
They're a long way away from putting this into service. And at the moment, they're kind of starting to go through trials, but really the vehicles we saw at the May Day parade were prototypes, really early prototypes. So this isn't going to come into service, probably in a realistic way for, at least a couple of years. And that's, if they're able to, keep funding it. The cost of these pieces of equipment are enormously expensive. A modern main battle tank, probably costs about $5 million a pop. If you're looking to buy thousands of these, very quickly you're talking about really large sums of money. And you're talking about very large sums of money to develop it. And, the Armata is, because it's not based on these old designs, they've had to create everything from scratch. So, in some ways that's new from a design point of view, and it allows them to add, a lot more armor. It's a much larger tank than the old tanks that it will eventually replace. But the kind of counter to that is you end up spending a lot more money.
Is there an American tank or British tank that would be directly comparable? I don't know if we're even developing new tanks here in the United States, but yeah, is anything comparable to it?
Well, at the moment, there's no effort in the US to replace the current US Army tank, which is the M1 Abrams, and neither in the UK, the Challenger 2, neither of those are on the slate being replaced at the moment. They do go through upgrade processes, and in the UK, we're about to launch a kind of limited upgrade of our Challenger 2. Really, you've got to look at this not in the case of the Russians have suddenly leapt forwards ahead of the US and the UK and the Germans and everyone else. Really what's happened is, as I said, the T-90 is basically this old T-72, which is a kind of equivalent of some of the later American M-60 Patton tanks. Essentially the Russians are a generation behind in some regards. We've had a generation since in the 90s that, came in and kind of replaced those tanks, whereas the Armata really is, bringing everything up to about the same generation as, where we are now, and also maybe taking it a little step further. But really, until you see this on the battlefield, and actually this comes into service in a meaningful way, it's very hard to say, how good this is going to be. But, modern tanks are so powerful, at taking out other tanks, that, I'd have thought an American tank would be perfectly capable of taking out an Armata, and vice versa.
There was a lot of talk not that long ago that maybe tanks weren't the most important weapon on a battlefield anymore. And when you're looking at Ukraine in particular, there were a lot of photographs showing Russian tanks fighting each other. And it looked to me like the war that everyone had been expecting in World War III in Europe. Does that change anything? Does that actually make the tank more important again?
Well, I think the tank always has been important. I think, a lot of naysayers of the tank, were only focusing on the kind of wars we were fighting in the West, over the last 10 years, which was, counterinsurgency conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, where, tanks aren't particularly important because you're not trying to fight other tanks, because the guys you're fighting, small arms is basically the extent of their equipment. As soon as you start fighting another country, then tanks become very important because, they're the kind of the most powerful thing on any battlefield, actually on the ground. Certainly, in Ukraine, we really saw that. And in the Syrian war at the moment, tanks are important.
Well, can you talk a little bit about Syria? Because I wondered if there are any similarities there to what happened with the Spanish Civil War, meaning that it's a place to try out weaponry and not directly along your own borders. Is any of that happening? Is Russia rolling out new equipment and trying it out in Syria?
To some extent, yes. A lot of these systems they've had for a long time, they just haven't been used in a war. What we didn't know about them was the exact capabilities and the ranges of the missiles or the aircraft, because they just hadn't been used in a conflict, right? So, to a certain extent, you know, a lot of these aircraft, you know, they get used in trials all the time. You know, they'll drop bombs and missiles and stuff all the time in Russia. So, this is less about actually kind of testing your own capabilities as about demonstrating your capabilities to other people, if that makes sense. In the Spanish Civil War, things, you know, like air power and bombing and, you know, saturation bombing of urban centers, you know, kind of the bomb motto of the 1930s, was something new, and that was kind of a new tactic that they were trying to implement. We're not seeing tactical innovation. What we're seeing is just demonstration of equipment capability to a greater extent, I'd say.
Does that mean that it's almost like an advertisement for Russian arms sales, as well as being a clear demonstration to any foes they might face?
Yeah, absolutely. It's absolutely that. You know, particularly with the missile capabilities, particularly with the naval capabilities, because Russia has quite a strong history of exporting naval vessels and military submarines abroad. And so, you know, having this capability combat proven is, you know, a really big selling point.
Let's change tracks a little bit. I want to ask you about the T-50 stealth fighter. It's what it is and where they are in the development cycle with it.
Right. So the T-50, it's also known in Russian as the PAK-FA is the acronym they use for it as well. It's their new stealth fighter. And it's kind of designed to be, the kind of the Russian equivalent of, say, an F-22 or an F-35. Much like, you know, the American equivalents is that it carries its weapons internally and the outside of it is kind of shaped and contoured, so it is less detectable to radar. I think at the moment they've got about 5 prototypes flying at this point. They did have one got quite an engine fire and burnt out, but I think they've now got that flying again. You know, they were originally planning to start rolling this out into service, so you start having operational squadrons in, you know, around this time, really. But, you know, the program's fallen behind schedule. And, you know, with the economic woes the Russians are facing at the moment, that, you know, there's quite a lot of talk in Russian media circles about, and defense circles about, you know, to what extent they're going to be able to commit to the T-50 or whether they're going to have to scale back their plans for that program. I mean, much as in the way, you know, the similar debate happened in the US with the F-22, I think the original plan was, you know, to have hundreds and hundreds of them, but they ended up with quite a small number.
And we're also facing cost overruns and all sorts of problems with the F-35 here as well. I think it's interesting that both fifth-generation fighters are having similar kinds of problems. You just mentioned the state of the Russian economy, and I think that's interesting. You know, the price of oil is collapsing. How is that affecting these weapons programs?
Well, I mean, at the moment this year, it's not affecting things. I think what it is affecting, because the Russian defense budget is still been growing. The Russian defense budget has grown massively. Absolutely massively over the past few years. Yeah, I think it's tripled in about 5 years. And that's part of a kind of a wider armaments program, which is trying to kind of, you've got to kind of cast your mind back to the end of the Cold War. And after the end of the Cold War, the Soviet Union collapses, and the Russians basically stop investing in defense equipment. So whereas in the US, the UK, we continued to invest, the Russians basically had a 15-year period where nothing really happened. They did develop some new kit, they didn't really buy anything. So everything is just got older and older and older. And probably even 15 years ago, it still wasn't as good as Western kit back then. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to replace all this. And so they've been throwing all this money at trying to improve the state of their armed forces. And they've got, you know, a pretty good way along with that. But they need to keep on growing their defense spending to meet all these plans they have, like for the T-50 stealth fighter or the T-14 Armata main battle tank. And the issue they have is with the price of oil as it is and the state of the Russian economy as it is with so reliant on oil and then also the effect of US and EU sanctions, which is important, particularly when combined with the collapse of oil. They could handle sanctions if oil was high, but because it's not, they can't. You know, it's going to mean they're going to have to actually, not only they're not going to be able to keep growing their defense budget, but you know they're going to have to start trimming their defense budget, and that means that all of these really big plans are going to have to be scaled back. And something the Russians have been trying to do was to co-develop some of their new equipment types with foreign partners. So, for example, the T-50 is meant to be the basis of a collaboration project with the Indians, the FFGA program. Basically, a version of the T-50 the Indians would buy and co-develop part of it. And they've been having real troubles in their talks with the Indians about trying to get this through. At various points, it seemed like a done deal, and then it kind of falls by the wayside. So quite the future of how well they'll be able to actually export the T-50 is a good question.
That's interesting when you think about Russia and America competing with each other in terms of arms sales to various allies. So how has the invasion of Ukraine also affected kind of the defense industry? Because there was the Russian defense industry did have ties to various Ukrainian companies. Kind of what's gone out the window now? How has that impacted them?
It's had a really big impact on the Russians. It's had a really big impact on the Ukrainians. You've got to think, the Soviet defense industry lost large sections of it when the Soviet Union collapsed because they ended up in Ukraine or Belarus or wherever else they might have been. So a lot of these companies, make parts for, say, Sukhoi or something. They're always part of the Soviet Union, but they just happened to end up when the Soviet Union collapsed. They weren't in Russia anymore. They're now in Belarus or Ukraine. When that happened, there was two kind of really main elements that were really important for Russian defense programs ended up in Ukraine. One was the Kharkiv Design Bureau, which was one of the two main Soviet tank design and factories. That ended up in Kharkiv. And the other one was a company called Motosich, which builds engines for helicopters, and also one of its current subsidiaries builds gas turbines for warships. And pretty much every single Russian military helicopter has a Ukrainian-built engine in it from Motosich. And pretty much every single Russian warship has a Ukrainian-built engine in it. The fact that Ukraine has stopped all exports of products to Russia has had a really big impact. And we've seen deliveries of new Russian naval vessels slowed down as a result of this. And if you look at their surface navy vessel plans, their big, their three main frigate programs are all beset by engine supply issues because they can't get them. And the delivery rate for helicopters domestically has also been impinged. The Ukrainians are still supplying engines to the Russians for export customers, just they're not shipping them to Russia. Russians have they're having to spend a very large amount of money on developing these systems in Russia or creating production lines for them. But it's not necessarily that the Russians don't have the capability to be able to make them. A lot of Motosich engines are actually designed in Russia anyway. They're just built in Ukraine. It's just that it wasn't economical for them to do so, to build factories and invest in the machinery in Russia when they could be made for cheaper in Ukraine by an existing facility. So they're having to spend all this extra money at a time when they need to not be spending money they don't have, looking to build stuff in Russia for more money than they'd previously been able to buy it from Ukraine or wherever. And suddenly that's having a big impact on them. But another thing that's had an impact on the Russians is not from the kind of financial point of view, but is the fact that the West has now put an arms embargo on further exports of equipment to the Russians. So for example, one of the main differences between the T-90 tank and its T-72, the early T-72 predecessor, is that it's got a modern thermal sight on it, which is so important for a modern battlefield. And that sight is made in France. So at the moment now, they're not able to receive any more of these sights from France. So they're going to have to develop these in Russia or in Belarus because they have got a close working relationship with the Belarusians. And there are various other, equipment types, particularly with these thermal cameras for both for tanks and for attack helicopters and things like that, that they're now having to develop and pump money into at home.
So that might not be something that the Russians were thinking about during the initial takeover of Crimea, I guess.
No, I wouldn't have thought so. And I'd have thought when the Russians were maybe thinking about the consequences of invading Crimea, they were probably looking at it the point of view, where they're thinking oil is going to be, $100-something a barrel, whereas now what we're talking about, $30 a barrel. So the Russian economy would have had so much more ability to absorb all these costs when oil was riding high. They probably underestimated what the impact of sanctions were, but also the basis of the Russian economy has collapsed. So, you know, collectively, that it becomes quite a big issue.
We've talked about Russia a lot over the last few months in the media, and been so many articles about Russia actually flexing its muscles, showing off this terrific weaponry, showing a revamped armed forces that the West and the rest of the world now has to really stand up and take notice. It sounds like it's really not that simple at all, and that, in fact, the Russians might not be particularly strong right now, whatever it looks like in Syria. Would you say that's accurate?
To a certain extent, yeah, absolutely. I mean, your strength is always, it's always relative, isn't it? It's always relative to who else you're dealing with. And it's also relative to how willing you are to use your strength. What the Russians are showing at the moment is they've become very willing to use their strength. So even if, to a certain extent, that strength is quite brittle, you know, the kind of the foundations for Russian strength actually aren't that strong. A lot of their equipment is old. You know, they're having real economic issues at the moment that's going to affect them down the line. But still, if they're, you know, if they're up for the fight, that makes them, you know, a threat and dangerous to others. So the extent to which they're dangerous is kind of contingent on, you know, their willingness to use force. And at the moment, they are proving pretty willing to use force. And, you know, they have been pumping money into their military, so their military is stronger than it was 5 years ago. So from that point of view, it's worth taking notice of. But, you know, are they suddenly now, out of nowhere, you know, the global military superpower that the Soviet Union was? Then no, they're not. And I think often people, you know, they see the rise of Russia and think, oh, well, hell, this is a source of concern. But actually, you need to think, well, you know, where the Russians are now is probably, I don't know, where the USA was in, I don't know, 1995. You know, they've spent a long time not getting very far because they didn't do anything for so long. So the Russians are trying to catch up, but the West is very far in advance. I mean, the US military is by far the global hegemonic power on Earth. There really is nothing to rival it. It's enormous from a size point of view. It is exceptionally well-funded. I think the US spends on its military, you know, the same as, you know, all the next top 20 countries in the world combined. So, and you know, it has by far the best equipment. So, yes, the rise of Russia is a source of concern, but you have to look at it in perspective.
Nick DeLarinaga, thank you so much for the perspective. I definitely have a much better handle on what's going on. So thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to another episode of War College. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show, and we're happy to get ideas for future shows. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @_WarCollege. And we also post every episode to Reuters' Facebook page. And don't forget to subscribe on iTunes and or SoundCloud. Your ratings and comments will help other people find the show. And the positive ones also warm our hearts.
Next time on War College.
The problem, especially in the Baltics and in Poland, is you have countries that have a very nasty historical habit of poofing in and out of existence.